Welcome to Documentary Diehards, the show where three sports fans break down one 30 for 30 documentary each and every episode. Bren, Nick, Sam, we're back again reviewing a documentary called Playing for the Mob. Guys, how are you tonight?
Doing well, Ren. Watching the Timberwolves get rocked by the Raptors.
Oh, no.
Yeah, they're
down. I didn't know they were losing. I haven't seen it tonight.
At one point, they were up 18 in the, I think, late first, early second quarter, and now they're down 21.
Wow.
Yeah.
They're kind of squeaking their way to the finish line here after so many spurts of great play.
And when they're contending or at least competing for that sixth spot, too.
6 and 5 is still up in the still up for grabs if they can. They're what entering today. They're 2 spots back from that 6. So
yeah, it's very dependent on how the Nuggets do going forward. But
yeah, because the tough thing was it's the Nuggets and Mavs, right? That they're trying to pass.
Yeah,
I believe and they're, you know, when the Timberwolves were going on their crazy run, they were both like, you know, both of the other teams were doing really well too. So. Tough right. To make too much ground, but.
Yep, exactly. But, I mean, only a couple weeks away from a potential play-in game and a unique experience for Timberwolves fans. Doesn't happen every year, as we know. should we just jump into this documentary? Do we have anything else we want to talk about? Final Four or anything like that?
Yeah, Final Four, the most highly anticipated game potentially for men's going forward. Or that's what people are calling it with UNC Duke. So that's, I mean, that'll be an exciting game, obviously, and big rivalry, first time they've ever met. And
that's what I was gonna say. Is that crazy?
Which is just insane to me, but
first time they've ever met in the Final Four or in the tournament?
In the tournament at all is the stat I heard.
Wow. Yeah, I think you're right. That's crazy. Like,
yeah, you think of how many times they both had, you know, very dominant teams that, you know, everybody's picked them to go to the Final Four and meets or the championship and meets and. Yeah, kind of crazy that it hasn't, but yeah, and then on the other side, Villanova and Kansas is probably the favorite, just because they're the only one seed left, but they haven't looked the greatest, had kind of an easier road to get to the Final Four, I'd say, and then Villanova is just like the steady rock that, you know, great coaching gets them there, and you have to look at them as one of, you know, the greatest programs, at least as the tournament goes in the last 10 years. So
they really are just steady every year. I mean, I picked them to go to the Final Four, but I haven't seen a game all year. I was just like, yeah, they're always so good, fun to watch, and here they are.
And I feel like they changed the narrative. I feel like they had the narrative of, like, Gonzaga, that at least Gonzaga used to have, where it was like, oh, they don't play anybody, and, like, you know, they'll be great in their conference, but then they won't get to the Final Four, or, you know, make it far. But that's been, you know, far from the truth in the last 10 years or so. So,
yeah. Blue Bloods, kind of. And I was thinking about this in the women's side, it's sort of the more recent Blue Bloods that are in the women's Final Four, like the South Carolinas. I mean, them and UConn are like the two, like, you know, mainstays, perennial powers. Yeah. But then, like, Stanford is, you know, has won it before. And so, yeah, it's kind of similar. There's like 3-1 seeds in the women's, which is here in Minneapolis starting.
The other team? Day, so.
Louisville, isn't it?
Yeah, Louisville, and they're another one seed. I don't know how historically they've been, but they haven't been historically like bad or anything, as far as I know. Yeah, it should be fun.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Like we said, I'll just do a quick recap of this documentary. It's called Playing for the Mob, and it basically centers around a couple Boston College basketball players in 1978 and 79, that basketball season. And some point shaving that was happening during that season in coordination with some members of the mob, basically. And the interesting thing is that these characters, these people, these mobsters, they were kind of running this, fixing games and stuff like that, were the same characters that Goodfellas was based off of. And that this was a major storyline within the movie Goodfellas. Quick question, has anyone seen it? I have not. I'm assuming you guys haven't either.
Sadly, I have not.
Yeah.
I have not either.
You're not either. Yeah, I hadn't either, and I came into this, I was like, oh, another time when I should have seen this movie, but it's all right. It's an Al Pacino, Robert De Niro movie that is a classic, obviously. But so yeah, this was in 1978 and 79. And it just kind of talks about like the basically two best players and then another player on the team were involved in this, where they're getting paid. We don't know how much or how often, maybe just once, to throw, not throw games, but, you know, basically cover the spread and help, you know, shaving points, basically, you know, making mistakes to keep it under a certain number of points. They actually went into a lot of explaining, you know, how betting worked in this, and we're like, this is kind of rudimentary sports gambling stuff. But this was about an hour and 18, I think, is what it was in length. Came out first on October 7th of 2014, directed by John Levine. And it was actually narrated by Al Pacino, who played the guy, one of the main mobsters in Goodfellas, and named Henry Hill, who was like the guy that ratted everybody out at the end of this whole scheme, and ratted out the big mobster that the FBI was after. So this documentary really wove kind of a lot of stuff together, including like some of one of the big robberies that the main mobster that the FBI was going after, that he committed. So they wove that within the storyline of the point shaving with Boston College. They talked about how the players got involved, what the fallout was after it ultimately became publicized, how it affected their lives or didn't. And yeah, that's kind of basically it. And it kind of really talked to everyone except for people that were not around. And one of the players on the team didn't want to be, who kind of introduced them to this, the mobsters, was not interviewed. Everybody else was. What were your guys' thoughts on this one, Nick? What'd you think of it after you watched it?
Yeah, I thought it was very interesting. It kind of like with the prelude, or, you know, where they talk about it a little bit at the beginning of the documentary, like, oh, what is this, or what can you expect from this? You know, they talked about like, this is going to be a drama, like this is a a dramatic documentary. It talks, you know, about the behind the scenes stuff that was going on. And I feel like that was a really good point. I feel like they did a really good job of doing that. I was surprised with how many interviews they got from, the people that were in on the fix, the people that were in on the team. They were missing the one guy, like you mentioned, Ren, but they kind of tried to use his testimony at least and put in some audio clips of that to try to at least give him or allow him to have his perspective that he gave in court in this documentary. So, I was impressed that they got as many interviews as they got, I think was my first overall impression. You guys know anything with me, anything with college basketball, I'm going to be, 10 times more interested in. And so it was kind of fun to see that, but I didn't feel like it was shoving basketball down like someone's throat either. If it was like someone who didn't enjoy basketball watching this documentary, it was more of like a dramatic piece. So, that's kind of my overall like first impressions. How about you, Sam?
Like you said, I was pretty impressed with the amount of interviews they were able to get. It was really cool to hear from them. And again, just like in our last documentary, hear different angles of every story that was told, right? So that was really fun. I think one of my main takeaways from this doc was my own personal opinion is that docs are made so much better by seeing footage of games and whatever else. And although they did show some Boston College games and some highlights and stuff, it wasn't the main focus of the story. And so the main focus of the story was a lot of times, you know, one person on the camera telling their version of the story. And although it was a story worth telling, I wasn't always super interested in what they were saying, or there's just times where I found myself wanting more or thinking that maybe it was going to be like a little crazier of a story than they sold it to be, especially the players. Like, they definitely undersold how big of a role they played in it. And so, it was interesting. What do you think, Ren?
Yeah, that's interesting that you bring up the part about the video, the game video. I hadn't really thought about that, but I think I totally agree in that. Yeah, it was probably hard for them but they probably should have dug through the video and looked for maybe a pass that was questionable, and maybe just tried to present that as these are some of the ones that that some people think are when they were intentionally making mistakes in order to, you know, shave points. That would be an undertaking to do and to produce and to find and stuff, but that was a big part of it, right? I do also agree that I thought about this, that they did kind of oversell the player's role in it. It may be to dramatize it, and they didn't lie or anything, but at the end, yeah, they came off and it was like this one guy, I forget his name, that when played in Israel, he probably ended up only ever taking one payment of a grand, and that's it. Now, we don't know 100%, but that's pretty much what everyone agreed on. He went, did a lie detector and all that thing. But he was still a part of it, obviously. And then the other guy, Jim Sweeney, who was like one of the main characters, he was interviewed a lot, talked a lot, like the captain of the team, he was the second guy that got involved in on the fix. And his story was pretty interesting. I thought it was really compelling. His roommate was Mike Mayock from the NFL Network / Oakland Raiders GM. Sam was perked up as soon as he saw that, I'm sure.
That was one of the most random things that we've ever seen in a documentary. And we're on like documentary 60 or whatever. Yeah. And Mike Mayock shows up and I'm like, huh, it's weird that they're having Mike Mayock, you know, NFL analyst talk about this documentary. And then it says roommate.
Yeah, like what are the odds of that? That's hilarious. There was another one where someone was a roommate with somebody, but I don't think it was quite that far of a leap.
Wasn't it R. Kelly? R. Kelly was a teammate of...
Oh, the Chicago one.
Yeah, Benji?
Benji. Yeah, but that's not the one I'm thinking of. I thought Allen Iverson was like a roommate wherever he went with somebody else that was...
I think at Georgetown, I think.
Yeah.
I'll look it up.
Yeah, I don't know. Anyway, I overall did think this was a little dry that you might have alluded to, Sam, because they were really in the weeds. And like you said, Nick, I think it was much more, and this is not bad for a 30 for 30 produced by ESPN. I think it objectively was more of a crime documentary than a basketball documentary, especially with the amount of basketball B-roll that they like to use or not use, which is fine, because it was, you know, it was about games. A lot of it was not, but I think the reason they produced this is because there were so many interesting factors, right? It was the huge crime boss that came down. It was the sports aspect, and it was the Goodfellas aspect. So they're like, oh, you know, like a extremely huge Hollywood movie, and so it all came together, and that's why they made it. I wouldn't say it was like one of my favorites of all time I've watched, but yeah, I thought it was interesting for sure.
How I would say it is, like, it was a story worth telling for sure. I just don't know if a documentary is the way to tell it. Like, do you think it would be better in like a newspaper article or a magazine article, or maybe even like a podcast,
or like a feature on The Athletic or something when Boston College basketball, you know, was really good or something like that? Yeah. Or if it were to be,
I mean, they did get the fact that they got all these interviews and the people were willing to go on camera, I think is enough to make the documentary. So I think they should have, just because they got all these ex-cons, like all these ex-mobsters and all the people pretty much involved in the thing. Now, yeah, I think it could have been done a little bit differently. And overall, if we're going to talk about the production, I think it was much too long. It's kind of an old criticism we have, but it really did go on, I thought. And it was 1 hour and 18, so it's not overly long, but it is, you know, they've done many shorter ones. And especially with the level of, like, involvement of the scale of the crime, it was a little maybe too much, I don't know, just too blown out of proportion a little bit. I mean, that's the wrong term, but yeah, I thought it was a little dry and maybe dragged.
I did think, you know, kind of what we're alluding to, or to go along with, like, you know, this was kind of overblown as far as how big of a scandal it was. At time, I mean, I guess you could argue the prison sentences, which say that's a huge scandal. But like at the end of all of this, like how did they find out about it? It was an incidental finding from a different investigation. And that is Henry Hill. Is that his name?
Yeah.
I mean, he just runs his mouth and talks out of his butt and doesn't know what he's saying from left to right. And this was like an incidental finding when they were interrogating him on something else. So that's like the first thing. That's like, okay. And then how they used it to pin the other guy that they really wanted in jail. They just used this to pin him in jail because they couldn't use it or figure out anything else against him. But the fact that this whole scandal led to only 8 games were fixed and only 5 were fixed successfully. I mean, just flip a coin. And if you're gambling, this only gives you one game better out of 8 games, you know, chance if you're just going flip of the coin. So I thought, you know, that was an interesting where it was like this big story that was played upon, but then it was like the effectiveness of the point shaving was like negligible. Like,
right. It wasn't even like a quarter of the season.
Yeah.
And arguably some people said that it wasn't the wins and losses that were even determined. Like these games would have had the same result just by a different score, maybe a wider margin or a smaller margin.
Yeah.
So yeah, I agree with that. And I mean, I do, just to play devil's advocate, I agree that it was a big, it was an important thing because the trial of this case led to them getting this big crime boss that they couldn't get any other way, who was like responsible for all this stuff, and they could never mm-hmm. prove anything except for this one sort of silly, you know, relatively thing. So yeah, I do think that was, I mean, significant. But yeah, I mean, I agree with the rest of what you said. It was small, and maybe it was made to seem not as small.
I also found myself wanting to hear more about the bigger crimes that guy committed rather than the point shaving, like when he stole like $9 million in cash or something. It was a big heist. I was like, I would love to watch a documentary on this guy and how he orchestrated all of this rather than, you know, some player getting paid $1,000 or whatever. But
I guess you got to watch Goodfellas.
I want to. That'll be this week's project.
I want to too. There was a couple bummers for me just to hear. Number one was this. So at the end, a newspaper, you know, the news was breaking. Boston Globe reporter just named a player on the roster that completely shouldn't have been named as in being involved, and his like career got ruined. And she was interviewed in this and was very tacky about the way she addressed it. She's like, yeah, some names were coming out. And so as a reporter, that's like absolute embarrassment. And yeah, that can't happen. And then the other one was the Sports Illustrated article that Henry Hill contributed to while he was being investigated. They like paid him 10 grand and then he clearly just made up a whole bunch of stuff because before he couldn't remember any of it. And so the Sports Illustrated paid him 10 grand, which bummed me out. And I guess maybe I'm naive, but I'm sure with magazines this happens, but it was a bummer to hear that. And especially to see that the article was, you know, I mean, not super credible from how they presented it. So what I wanted to ask you guys is, what do we think about Jim Sweeney? Is that what his name? The captain, one of the guys who, the guy that started it, Rick, said that he was more involved than he says he is. He says he was only involved to a very limited extent. What do we think? Because that's kind of the question that was left unanswered. What do we think?
Oof. You want to take this first or should I, Rudy?
You can take it.
All right.
I want to see what you have to say.
All right. That's tough. I kind of want to, in my head, I want to believe him and think that it was old Dirty Rick who was screwing over all his friends. Rick. And Rick. Yeah. That's kind of my thoughts, is that Rick got caught up in some bad business, brought his best friend Jim into things. And then I do think that Jim played up the whole, like, I didn't know anything that was going on. I just played my normal game and stuff. He played that card way too often in the doc. But I do think that Rick was more so the mastermind behind it and deserves more of the blame than Jim.
I would agree for the most part. I mean, I think that he would have had to have been so naive to have actually been as innocent as he is portraying, I feel like. And I feel like if you're a big, you're a big shot at a university, like, you're involved. I mean, just the people that are trying to involve themselves with you, I feel like you can't be that naive or that sheltered. But they even went as far back to show, like, oh, I wanted to go to a Catholic university just for a for a good Catholic, you know, like, background and whatever. And I'm like, I mean, that's good if that was true, but, like, as the documentary, you know, spun out more, I was like, I don't know if I agree with, like, if I believe that as much anymore. And especially, I don't know, you guys tell me what you think about this, but he didn't even tell his girlfriend about it. And the girlfriend and now wife, you know, mentions, like, oh, he was being such a protector of me. But I don't know, you could also look at that that's more damning, because he didn't want her to know what he was also involved in or what he was doing. So I don't know if that's as much of a, you know, proving his innocence that as it is just, you can look at it both ways. I didn't think about that until just now, but
I never thought about that either. Why did he tell his roommates and not his girlfriend?
Yeah.
Mike Mayock, obviously.
This is Mike Mayock. He's like, you're going to be the terrible GM for the, I mean, GM for the Raiders. Okay, I think he had a lot more to do with it than he let on. Just because he's in his interviews and stuff, I wasn't buying it. Like, because he, and I mean, I totally agree, the Rick guy was way more responsible. He brought him in, and I do think he Jim was hesitant and stuff like that, but I do think they threatened him probably, and he was afraid, but I don't think he was, like, trying 100% every game. Like, I think he basically said, I never tried to mess up and do anything. I think he participated out of fear, and he made sure that he kind of he covered his tail in so far as that. Like, he did admit to, like, getting paid once or something, it was pretty unfortunate. I don't put a ton of blame on him and a Cobb for the other guy, but I think Jim was more involved than Cobb was and more responsible. I think he wasn't completely honest with, like, what he has stated to the world about his involvement.
Yeah, I feel like he had the biggest reputation to uphold as well, that, you know, he has to maintain that or continue to uphold it, or at least he's felt like that. He had more expectations on him. He was the Eagle of the year or whatever.
Yeah. Also, some of the narrative in the documentary kind of rubbed me the wrong way, because they were saying, like, how he was this perfect Boston College kid. He's the perfect bus, the just the great, you know. And then they're like, yeah, but the best player was this black guy, and that's basically how they presented it. I was like, okay, chill. First of all, this guy is not the best player on the team. And they're like, yeah, this is the All-American kid.
Oh, that's so true. I didn't really.
Was like a little cringy how they're.
Because Cobb was averaging like 23 a game or whatever they said, but then they just focused on Sweeney the whole time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, they focused on Sweeney the whole time, but then they're also like, oh, look at Sweeney driving his, like, Mercedes-Benz around because he sold his software company.
I know, and they revealed that, like, oh, he's been super successful in sales or whatever.
Yeah.
What is sales? Like, lying to people? No.
So this seems like something that you could very easily have done, and I feel like the mob could have easily gotten involved in college basketball in a lot of ways that we never knew about. You know, the FBI didn't even find out about this until years later.
Wasn't on purpose, yeah.
Wasn't on purpose. So do we think this has happened before, and will it happen again?
Well, I mean, it definitely has happened before, right? There's been cases that they that of it happening.
But more often than we've heard about is what I mean.
More. Oh yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I'm sure. Cause it feels like it's not that incredibly hard to not get caught if you do it at a smaller scale, especially, right? You just have like a bookie away and you make whatever you can make. Will it happen again? Yeah, I'm sure it's happening right now, probably, unfortunately. But the only like redeeming thing, especially at the end, they're talking about how these college athletes, most of them are broke, and yeah, money looks good to them until they'll do it. Nowadays, hopefully with the NIL, that helps. Like they get money for what they do, some of them, in some way. So maybe that, you know, dissuades people from doing whatever it takes to, you know, make ends meet. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, you want to hope that it's not happening, that it won't happen again. But I feel like that's kind of naive thinking as well. History tends to repeat itself. So, you know, if someone comes up with an idea like this, and when they blatantly were, apparently, but you go back and you watch a video. I mean, what's the difference between someone purposely throwing it out of bounds or missing a shot or just cracking under pressure because they have the pressure of the situation? So it's really tough to decipher that, and to prove intent is so tough, even just with just video. So yeah, I mean, you know, that I feel like that it's a tough thing to prove, so it's almost like you could get away with it easy ish if you handled the off the court stuff really well, I guess. You know, and it's also like, you know, when they, depending on how you bet, you know, betting versus the spread, you know, if they still win, then, you know, it kind of brings in the element of, is it as bad as it seems? You know, point shaving has such a poor context or like a connotation along with it, but is it as bad? I mean, if you win by 3 points versus like 7 points, I mean, you still, like, in the grand scheme of things, you know, the main thing about sports is win or loss. So not saying that it's okay or it should be encouraged, but it's not as bad as, like, in a sports environment as I feel like it is on just a gambling. It's not a fair bet for the people that were on the other side of it. So I think that argument could be made.
It's still a win in the win column. I listened to a podcast a year or two ago, and it was all about Tim Donahue, the NBA referee.
Oh, you've told me about that. I need to look that up sometime.
It's really interesting. You guys would both enjoy it. But he talks about how I don't know if he talks about it, but someone in the podcast talks about that Tim Donahue used to say that he could basically move an NBA game's points spread by like 6 points during a game without anybody realizing it. So whether it's like calling a late whistle or like a foul, or, you know, sending the ball the other way for whatever reason it is, or helping someone fall out, like stuff like that can go a super long way. And so if it might not even be just the players doing it, like it could be referees. And now, like, you could place a wager on your phone, so it doesn't even have to be the mob anymore. It could just be like a frat who's like, hey, let's go get that point guard, and we're all gonna go on mybookie.ag on our phone and put 20 grand down on Minnesota to win by 10 tonight or something, you know.
Totally. I mean, I literally just watched like a video on Instagram like yesterday that some, I don't know if it was Donahue or whoever, but he was dealing with Allen Iverson, and he had a beef with him, and the officiating crew that game decided to, you know, go after Allen Iverson basically. And then they told their friends to bet the other way. And then like Allen Iverson knew it was happening. Like apparently he came up to the official and he's like, how long is this going to last? Cause he already knew he didn't like him. And he's like, I don't know what you're talking about. And they both like smiled at each other. They both knew how messed up it was. That's what the video was. I don't know which rep this was, but it's a former guy that was busted.
Well, then yeah, there's like the stats of, like, is the LeBron James with Joey Crawford? Is that the ref's name? Where it's like I think he's really good with him. Like he wins all the NBA playoff games with him, or, you know,
yeah,
very much more. So
And I mean, even in pro sports, like, it's a little more extreme, right? And we just had Julio, or not Julio Jones. Who was it? The Falcons that just got
suspended. Calvin Ridley.
Calvin Ridley. I mean, he was injured at the time or whatever, supposedly. And, you know, but yeah, I mean, it's, and now with just it being so, I mean, it's on every, like, the lines are now so much more prevalent. Betting is just getting bigger and bigger. It's getting legal in every state eventually. And, so it's just going to be more people involved, more money and stuff.
That's all. Yeah, I think it brings up the argument, is it truly a good thing, you know, to have sports gambling so readily available, especially as we're getting it, you know, now you can just do it from the comfort of your own home, depending on what state.
Yeah, the live betting for stuff too. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, there's so many different factors for that. But anyways, let's give it a rating. I can go first. I honestly liked it, but I didn't rate it high because of I didn't like a lot of something. So 5.95 Israeli basketball leagues, because our guy Cobb, I think his name was, one played 17 years in Israel, which is pretty cool. I remember when Isaiah Thomas, the more recent guy, went and played there. I think he did. And then, like, I know Nate Robinson played there for at least a season in the past like 10 years. But anyway, 5.95, just because of the reasons kind of we talked about, kind of dragged on. But I did learn a good amount. This wasn't one where I came away going, oh, I'm really glad that I learned this. I'm happy to have, but it wasn't one of those I was like, I should have known this before. Like, I'm not heartbroken that I didn't know this before. What about you, Sam?
Yeah, I agree. It was fun to learn about, but I found myself leaving like underwhelmed, thinking that there was going to be just this crazy tale of millions of dollars going in and out. And it wasn't as wild as we said. As Rudy said, 5 out of 8 games actually went the way that they wanted them to, which is pretty underwhelming when you think about a whole documentary around it. So with that being said, there was some good parts to it. The interviews were good. It was a story worth telling, like I said. And it made us think more just about sports gambling and its place in our current society. So I'm going to give this one, what did I give it? 6.12 Boston accents. So I was very in line with Ren. What do you got, Rudy?
Well, I had the same rating qualifier, Boston accents, because that just took over. I mean, that was like one of the first things that I noticed right away. I just want to mention one other thing. Brooks Pearl was interviewed in this. He was a student assistant for this team. And I just found it very ironic because he's had some NCAA infractions against him even. And so I thought it was very interesting to get his perspective on this, or at least what he said. And I mean, you can say what you want about some of the NCAA rules that he violated, but it was funny. I just had to laugh at the irony the whole time of
yeah, that. Yeah, I didn't know specific. I knew he got in trouble before. Does Bruce Pearl remind you of Ed Orgeron or whatever his name is, the former LSU guy? To me, he always does.
I could see that, yeah. just a different, like, yeah, personality. I mean, one you can't you can't understand Orgeron at all.
Yeah.
but kind of that lovable heads. Figure that just embraces them in a culture, in the campus culture and that. Yeah. So I thought that was ironic throughout the whole thing. But I'm going to give it a 6.8 Boston accents. Yeah, I felt like it was mostly an entertainment documentary more than like a sports documentary. So it was a little different, but I really liked the interviews. Docked it for also how it relied so much on Goodfellas. So you had to have seen it or it probably would have made a lot more sense if we would have seen that before. And I feel like that took away from it, because then you're just, you know, greatly narrowing that audience, especially for people like our age. I feel like Goodfellas may still be something that a lot of people have seen, but a lot more of our generation has not seen it compared to, you know, like our parents, for example. So yeah, I just felt like it kind of narrowed the audience there, but I still liked it overall.
Yeah, that's true. I think it would have been probably more engaging because they did weave the clips in. And there was one at the end when he was on the stand, like Al Pacino was, that I recognized that clip. And I was like, oh, so like that whole time I could have been doing that if I'd seen the movie. Okay, very good.
So this averaged 6.29, which puts it 35th out of 58.
Sweet. Not a really high one like we've had in the past. I think two were pretty high. Maybe the past three. Let's move on to Mount Rushmore. We're doing a very specific one today. Mount Rushmore is with tattoos that we get, like theoretically or in the future, I guess. I'm personally not a big tattoo guy. I don't have any. I don't think any of us have a tattoo, but I'm going first, it looks like, and then Sam and then Nick. So I'll start. The one I've thought about, if I was to, would just be to be my last name, which is Suanaso, which is long. It's like 12 letters. But what I would do is I put it like up on my upper back somewhere, but I would have it like in a rainbow shape, just because that's how it used to be on my like uniforms, my sports jerseys growing up when I played Little League and whatever. Because it's so extremely long, and because I don't use my real last name for professionally, so it would be like a family homage. That's the one that I've had locked and loaded from thinking about previously.
Is there a reason that you don't? Is it just so it's easier to say Clayton, or?
Well, it's easier to remember, just basically for the public. And I've thought about changing it back, to be honest. Like when I moved back here and got this job here, I thought about changing it back because I'd be back home and stuff. And I still may, but at this point I probably wouldn't. But yeah, originally, like when I was like sending out job applications, like I wanted to be as, you know, easy to, I don't know, like hire or whatever, and to remember and be a little less hard to pronounce, hard to spell, which sucks in a way, but that was kind of decision making there.
Gotcha.
How did you decide on Clayton?
Oh, that's my middle name. So it's still my real name, but it's just my middle name. Yeah.
Gotcha. I missed that. All right. I have second overall pick. I'm going to go with, I would do something about the marathons that I've ran, and it would be something like, I don't know, to commemorate like each one that I've done, if that makes sense. Cause I want to eventually get to the point where I've run, I don't know, dozens of them. I don't know how many it'll end up being, but it'd be cool to have some sort of like check, tally system or something.
You just build the sleeve, right?
Yeah, exactly. A nice little sleeve with a little tally system somehow in a creative way, not just tallies, that's boring, but a way to commemorate each one.
So I got two in a row. First one I would do is like, it's pretty common within like a running college cross country, but like putting it on like your upper thigh. So then like the logo of your college team. But like if you ran somewhere and had a lot of pride in that team, or like, I know like Luther, like they all do that, right? And then like lacrosse, like a lot of them do that, and like the U and stuff like that. So that'd be pretty cool. Or I've always thought that would be decent.
Why upper thigh? Is that because it shows when you're running?
Yeah. Just with your short shorts.
Yeah.
Big old CU right on the old thigh.
Would you go or CU or CSP?
Would you go CU or CSP?
I'd probably go CSP. CU, everybody would be like, oh, Colorado.
Yeah.
Which is what we always got in the airport and traveling.
Yeah, I've gotten that just wearing those sweatshirts.
Yeah. And I don't know. I mean, I like the CSP logo. I think it's kind of slick, but I know other people don't. But yeah.
All right,
what next? Next one. I would probably just go with the classic like cross, just like a faith tattoo of some sort, just because that means a lot to me and would be something that I wouldn't mind on my body.
Nice.
This is tough. So my mom passed away in 2012, So if I ever did, a lot of my family members got like cancer ribbons and stuff because she passed away of cancer. I don't think I would ever get a cancer ribbon. I'm not a huge fan of that personally, but I would try, I would probably do something to commemorate her or like remember her by, I guess.
Nice. I got two. So I would do a, my siblings have like a sibling tattoo idea. One of my siblings has it. It's just like a bird outline because all four of us have bird. Our first names are also birds. So my name's Ren. My sister's Mina, Jay, and Finch. So like my little brother already has a bird like tattoo. So like, and everybody's trying to get one. I've always said, no, I'm not going to do it, but who knows, eventually I might. I don't know. But so that would probably be up there on the list.
That's cool. And, I didn't realize that.
Yeah. Well, so that's one of the sibling ideas, right? And then the other one, actually, wait. Yeah, the other one is actually what my brother has. So we talked about two different ideas. And this one is just an outline of Laos, which is I'm half Lao. My dad came over from Laos as a teenager. So that's the one my brother has. The bird one is not, no one has it yet. But yeah, that would just be another one, like heritage tattoo. I don't know where I'd get these tattoos. It'd probably be like on my back or something, but I haven't really thought that far.
Is that going to be your second choice then?
Yeah.
Last tattoo. All right. The third overall pick. I'd probably do some sort of like travel themed, whether it's like a globe or a map or something, and either like commemorate places I've been or just make it like a general theme of like travel, just to, cause I really like to travel and I value it. I'd never got to travel as a kid. And so like, I've really tried to take advantage of it as much as I can now that I can do it on my own.
You could do like a little airplane zooming.
Little airplane with a globe. Yeah, something like that. I'm sure there's some amazing ones out there I can copy.
You guys can tell me if this is basically what Sam said as far as marathons, but I've always thought like if I ever did a Ironman, like there's no way I would not get an Ironman tattoo. Cause I think like you would have to show that off.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
I don't know if I ever told you this, Rudy, but I was running Boston and I looked up and I was like running right in behind a guy who had an Ironman tattoo on his like calf. And my first thought was like, well, I'm going to lose to that guy. Like, that guy's tougher than me.
Yeah. Right.
What do they look like? I would
love to try someday, but man, you really earned that tattoo.
It's hard to explain. It's like almost like a stick figure, like a filled in stick figure almost, like a boxy stick figure.
Mm.
And some people like get writings as for like what they did or what, where they did it kind of a thing.
It's not like an Iron Man helmet from Marvel.
No, but you could do that too.
So I would do that one. I could go with the cliche UNC championship in 2022, but if that actually were to come true.
Or go really big and go Minnesota in 2023.
Right now, put it on me.
Or you could do, one potential. You have a kid now. You could do something kid related.
Yeah.
Possible.
Probably their birthdays, so I don't forget them, right?
Yeah.
I'm gonna go with a punishment tattoo, because if I truly look at myself and I were to get a tattoo, I do feel like a top four reason for getting a tattoo would probably be like I lost a bet, or I lost like my fantasy football season, or something like that, and that's the reason I got a tattoo. So I can't even say what the tattoo is. It's just more of the idea of a punishment tattoo.
Man, I hope our fantasy league never requires that, because I would be getting it.
I hope it does.
I lose like every year.
that's funny.
Well, this is my fourth tattoo in the last 5 years.
Yeah.
Classic.
I'll have a full sleeve by the time it's said and done if we start requiring that.
And that, kids, is how I got my tattoo sleeve.
Which is going to lead to my last one. I would just get a sleeve. Definitely would be a top choice of mine. I think sleeves, if done right, there's some sleeves that I don't like. If you get like a colorful and well-designed one that flows nicely from and is meaningful to you, I think that sleeves are very, very cool. And I'd probably do a one-arm sleeve, save the other arm, just keep it fresh.
Straight for shooting threes.
Yeah, exactly. It's like my shooting sleeve. Throw it on my right arm.
One sleeve, professional.
Exactly.
One sleeve for business. All right. My last one actually is can be a sleeve or not, but it's like a Polynesian tattoo. Because like that's a, I mean, and so I would probably never do this just because I would have to research and make sure I'm not like appropriating Polynesian culture. But when I lived in Hawaii, like that's a big thing. It's a cultural thing to have. The Polynesians, I'm sure you got, here's like a picture, but what it looks like, I'm sure most people know, like, that's kind of the,
oh yeah,
like those kind of patterns, I'm sure you've seen them, people have them on their legs and arms a lot, so, like, people from any of the Polynesian islands, Hawaii, Fiji, you know, any one of them, but I've just always thought those look so cool, and I usually don't think, like, tattoos look like, I'm not usually excited about them, but I usually thought when I saw them, it was often in Hawaii. Looks super sick, so it's just a cool pattern, and that's also a cool kind of message. But yeah, I probably wouldn't just because I'm not Polynesian, but this is theoretical.
Fair enough. All right, we did Mount Rushmore of tattoos we'd get or consider. Ren went with his last name, a bird outline, louse outline, or a Polynesian tattoo sleeve type thing. I went with some sort of marathon tallying system, tattoo to commemorate my mom, travel themed, and just in general, a sleeve on one arm. Rudy went with a college logo on an upper thigh, very big runner thing, a faith or a cross tattoo, an Iron Man if he ever did one tattoo, and then he might end up having to get one as punishment for losing a fantasy football league. So that was his last choice.
Do you think anyone else will actually get a tattoo?
You think, what'd you say?
You think we actually will ever get one? It sounds like Sam's the most likely to get one.
Probably. Yeah. But how did none of us say a Doc Diehards not say a Doc Diehards?
The logo?
Yeah. We all gotta get one of those. Otherwise, we don't care about this podcast.
Guys, if I ever get a sleeve and we make it to 100 episodes, I'll throw logo in there.
Don't do a sleeve. Have it right over your heart.
I don't know if anyone in our league would actually get a tattoo. I feel like everyone would be like, either one, that's dumb, or two, like, no, I'm not doing that.
Yeah.
It was hard enough to get people to drink a beer fast, I think. So
yeah, I know.
No kidding. That's true. Red did like six takes and was like,
I got hammered. that was so funny. Okay. Last segment. Nick, do you have a documentary wish list idea, 30 that you like made?
I do. If you guys remember a while ago, I talked about my rival Wisconsin athletic director and talked about Barry Alvarez and a documentary about him and how much that pained me. Well, this one also pains me. And I would say that with the sign of the times, even though I've been sick of the Coach K, praise tour of his last year, there's got to be a documentary that's about him and his career. There's one out on ESPN right now that is it's entitled the Class That Saved Coach K. And so it talks about like his bumpy start to his career and then like this recruiting class that really changed it. I haven't seen it, but I feel like, and so if this focuses a lot on his career, I mean, I guess then I'm just stealing that material, but something that, you know, covers his Duke basketball, him as a person, his family, talks about him with USA Basketball, because he did that for many years, and just being a, you know, one of the best coaches in college basketball for so long. So, I mean, that's obviously warranted, given all his accomplishments. So I'm sure it's just a matter of time, but just, you know, with that, with this weekend being his last weekend of coaching college basketball, it's definitely warranted giving him a shout out from the Doc Diehard team.
And his last game coming up, right? Maybe.
Yeah, last game is Saturday night. By midnight, he'll be unemployed.
Unemployed. Do you think he's going to do TV? I bet he will. He'll be one of those guys that is terrible to TV reporters and then ends up doing working in TV. One of those classic.
I don't know. I mean, he's like 75, so it's like.
Is he really?
Mm-hmm.
Dang, yeah.
He just uses a lot of hair dye. But
you think he'll let it go gray after?
It could very well be a series like Tom Brady's series.
That's very true.
Maybe 14 episodes long, every Final Four he's made.
A lot of Coach K.
Although he's ran Dean Smith and Roy Williams, and they have more combined. But
are you sad that Roy Williams is not coaching in this final matchup?
I mean, yeah, that would have been awesome. I don't think they would be there if Roy was coaching, probably, but just how the last couple of years went, and I don't know. I mean, you can't really say anything for certain, but I do think that, not that Hubert Davis is a better coach, but just I think nowadays it's just like the kids are different, and
yeah.
I think that's what Roy Williams was seeing, and there's a lot of discussion on one of the UNC guys from last year, Walker Kessler, transferring to Auburn. And a lot of it was, you know, because he didn't want to play right, or he wanted to play right away. And Roy Williams was trying to kind of coach him up to be better his second, third year. And he wasn't having any of that, or he was too impatient or wanted more glory for himself. And so, some people will say that played a big role in Roy Williams stepping down last year. But yeah.
Interesting. I didn't know that story. All righty. Well, enjoy the Final Four, people. Sam, do we know what our next documentary will be?
We do, Ren. We are on episode 64 called The Day the Series Stopped. From October 14th, 2014, it's a 25-year retrospective of the Loma Prieta earthquake, which struck just before the scheduled start of Game 3 of the 1989 World Series.
1989. Wanted to figure out who was playing that. Okay, this was fun, guys. We'll see you next time.